So before we jump in, this deep dive is brought to you by SurfFuel. They've got a full Series 7 course with adaptive study quizzes, smart flashcards, and unlimited practice exams that are, weighted exactly like the real thing. You can check it out at surffuel.com.
Highly recommend.
Yeah, definitely. So, okay, imagine sending like a single tweet about a hot tech stock, right? You go to sleep, and then you wake up to a $50,000 fine, your license is suspended, and your compliance officer is having a literal meltdown in the office lobby.
Oh yeah, just a total disaster.
Right. And that is, I mean, that's the reality of the securities industry. We tend to think of regulations kind of like, traffic laws. Like you speed, you get a ticket, it's all very straightforward. But when it comes to how a broker-dealer talks to the public, the radar gun is completely hidden, the speed limit changes depending on who is sitting in the passenger seat, and the penalty for getting it wrong can't, well, it can literally end your career.
It is a phenomenal way to frame it. The regulatory landscape that we are jumping into today is just notoriously unforgiving. But I mean, it unforgiving by design. The rules governing communications with the public are the absolute bedrock of how the financial industry is allowed to, seek business. So we are going to be pulling apart the FINRA/RE rulebook today, specifically the 2210 series, which dictates every single word a registered representative can say, write, or broadcast.
And if you're listening to this to prep for your Series 7 exam, I mean, this is a massive area for easy points, right?
That
Or devastating unforced errors if you don't know it.
Oh, absolutely.
You really have to know the mechanics behind these rules, not just, blindly memorize flashcards, because my ADHD brain will just, it'll reject a dry textbook. So to keep us grounded and make this stick, we are going to use a recurring cast of characters today to test these FINRA/RE rules in the real world.
I love this. Let's do it.
Okay, so first we have Reckless Randy. He's an overenthusiastic, highly commissioned registered rep who basically views compliance rules as mere suggestions. Yeah, he is constantly dreaming up just terrible, highly illegal marketing schemes.
Yeah, I mean, every firm has a Randy, usually several Randys, to be honest.
Right, exactly. And then to balance him out, we have cautious Kathy. So she is the firm as eternally stressed out compliance principal.
Poor Kathy.
Her entire job is to review Randy as nonsense, sigh heavily, and basically try to keep the firm out of federal court.
The full-time job.
Oh yeah. And finally, we have Frank the founder. So Frank is a wildly wealthy client. He has over $50 million in total assets. Yeah, he's not a corporation. He's not a bank. He's just a guy who started a tech company, sold it, and now has an absurd amount of money and free time.
Okay, so using those three is going to highlight the friction points perfectly because the core philosophy of FINRA is entirely about context.
Context, okay.
Yeah, like who is speaking, who is listening, and what is the potential for deception? I mean, FINRA/RE's absolute worst nightmare is a sophisticated broker using complex financial jargon to trick a regular everyday person into betting their retirement on some, highly speculative derivative.
Right.
Every single rule we discuss today stems from that core anxiety.
Okay, that makes sense. So let's start with the plumbing, like the absolute foundation of this whole system. FINRA/RE categorizes every single piece of written or electronic communication a broker-dealer sends out into one of three buckets. And if you don't know the bucket, you don't know the rule, right?
Exactly. You're dead in the water. So the three buckets are retail communication, institutional communication, and correspondence. And the entire regulatory framework hinges on audience size and audience type.
All right, so I want to break these down because the math here is where the exam sets its very first trap. Let's start with correspondence. So the definition is any written or electronic communication that is distributed or made available to 25 or fewer retail investors within any 30 calendar day period. So small group, tight time frame.
Yeah, that is the threshold for what FINRA/SI considers somewhat normal, day-to-day business chatter, like, hey, just checking in. But the moment you cross that line, the moment Randy sends that email to 26 retail investors within that same 30 calendar day window, it magically transforms into the second bucket.
Which is a retail communication.
Exactly.
Okay, let me throw a scenario at you and anyone listening. Try to beat our expert to the punch here.
All right, lay it on me.
So Reckless Randy knows the rule. He knows 25 is the limit, so he wants to pitch a speculative penny stock to 26 different retail clients.
Classic Randy.
Right. But to outsmart FINRA, he doesn't use the BCC line on one mass email. No, he physically types out 26 individual personalized emails like, hey, John, look at this doc. Hey, Mary, look at this doc.
I see where this is going.
Right. He hits send 26 separate times, spread out over, let's say, 3 weeks. What bucket does this fall into?
I mean, I see people try to argue this in the real world all the time.
Oh, I bet.
It is a retail communication, period.
But they were individual emails.
Fenera does not care about the physical act of hitting the send button.
Okay.
The rule applies to the actual content being distributed. If the core message, that penny stock pitch, goes to more than 25 retail investors within a rolling 30 calendar day period, it crosses the threshold.
Right.
You cannot launder a mass marketing campaign by breaking it into individual emails. It doesn't work.
So it's about the substance of the message, not the delivery mechanism.
Exactly.
And that 30 day window is a rolling calendar too. It's not like it resets on the first of the month.
Nope.
Like if you send 15 emails on April 20th and 12 on May 5th, you just hit 27 in a 30-day window. You just triggered a retail communication.
You did. Which, by the way, brings a massive administrative burden down on Cautious Kathy, which we will get to in a moment.
Oh, can't wait.
But let's look at the third bucket first, which is institutional communication.
Okay.
This is content distributed exclusively to institutional investors. So we are talking about banks, savings and loans, mutual funds, insurance companies, governmental entities, things like that.
So professional money, institutions that have armies of lawyers and financial analysts.
Right.
So Federer assumes they don't need to be coddled or protected from Reckless Randy's aggressive sales pitches.
Precisely. The regulatory leash is much, much looser for institutions.
Which brings us to Frank the founder.
Ah, Frank.
Yes, Frank. Frank is a human being. He plays golf on Tuesdays. He probably eats way too much red meat. But he has $50 million in total assets.
Right.
Now, logically, I look at Frank and think, you know, he's a retail client. He's just a really rich one.
Sure.
Does Fenera see it that way?
No. Under the communications rules, Fenera actually considers Frank an institution.
Wait, really? A single guy?
A single guy. The specific rule states that any person, whether it's a natural person like Frank or an entity, with total assets of at least $50 million, they automatically qualify as an institutional investor.
Oh, wow. So Randy can just blast Frank with complex, aggressive institutional marketing materials, and Kathy doesn't have to treat it like a highly regulated retail piece.
She doesn't. But, and this is a big but, there is a massive operational hazard here that the exam just loves to test.
Okay, hit me.
It is the forwarding gotcha.
The forwarding gotcha.
Yeah. Let's say Randy sends Frank a highly technical, jargon-filled pitch about a private equity real estate fund. And Randy stamps institutional communication only in massive red letters across the top of the PDF.
All right, covering his bases.
Exactly. Yeah. But Randy happens to know that Frank loves sharing stock tips with his 30 broke cousins, none of whom have $50 million.
Uh-oh. I feel like the red stamp isn't going to hold up in FINRA court.
It absolutely will not hold up. If a member firm has reason to believe that an institutional communication will be forwarded to retail investors, the communication is instantly reclassified as a retail communication.
Wow.
The label you put on it is entirely irrelevant. The rule applies based on who the ultimate audience is.
Right.
You cannot use a high net worth client as a mule to smuggle institutional marketing to retail investors.
A mule. That's a great way to think about it. That makes perfect sense, too. FINRA cares about the destination, not the packaging.
Exactly.
Okay, I have one more curveball on these three buckets.
Let's hear it.
What if Randy is just furious that someone left fish in the office microwave again?
A valid reason to be furious.
Totally valid. So he types up an angry written email and sends it to the internal firm water cooler committee. There are only 12 people on this committee.
Okay.
Is that correspondence? Because, I mean, it as it's written and it's under 25 people.
It is incredibly tempting to classify it as correspondence based on the numbers.
Right.
But internal communications sit completely outside all three of those fine or categories.
Wait, really? The rule book doesn't classify internal emails at all.
It's a fascinating little carve out, actually. In the fine or rule book, the exception literally lives inside the definition of an institutional investor.
Huh.
Yeah, it states that internal communications are essentially treated like institutional comms in the sense that they aren't retail, but a firm cannot officially label their internal memos as institutional or correspondence. They are just internal.
Oh, I see.
FINRA's mandate is protecting the investing public. They do not care if Randy is sending unhinged emails about office microwave etiquette to his coworkers, provided those emails don't contain instructions to, you know, defraud clients.
Right, right. As long as it's just about the fish, FinerEye doesn't care.
Exactly.
So internal comms are off the board. We have retail, institutional, and correspondence. Now, everything we've talked about so far is written or electronic.
Right.
But what happens when reckless Randy actually leaves the office, stands in front of a crowd, and just opens his mouth?
Oh, this brings us to the wonderfully chaotic world of seminars and public appearances.
Oh, boy.
I like to call this the split personality event because the rules literally fracture depending on what medium is being used at any given second.
Okay, let's set the stage for this. Randy convinces cautious Kathy to let him host a retirement planning seminar at a local steakhouse.
Sounds dangerous already.
Extremely.
Yeah.
He invites 40 prospective retail clients. They're all sitting there eating their free mashed potatoes waiting for the pitch.
Right.
So Randy stands up at the front of the room, grabs the microphone, and just starts winging it. He's talking off the cuff, totally unscripted, about how great the stock market is. What is this categorized as?
So when Randy is speaking unscripted in a public forum, that is classified as a public appearance.
Public appearance. Got it. And because it is unscripted,
yeah.
Cautious Kathy obviously couldn't pre-approve what he was going to say, right? She doesn't have a time machine.
Right.
So FinerEye doesn't require principal pre-approval for a public appearance, do they?
That is correct. But do not mistake a lack of pre-approval for a lack of supervision.
Oh, okay.
NNRA demands that the firm have comprehensive written supervisory procedures covering public appearances.
Mm.
And this is a three-pronged requirement.
Right. What are the prongs?
First, Kathy has to provide education and training to Randy on what he is legally allowed to say before he ever picks up a microphone.
Good luck with that.
Right. Second, she must document that training. She has to prove she taught him.
Okay.
And third, the firm must have post-event surveillance. They need to monitor what happened to ensure Randy didn't promise 40 people guaranteed 20% returns while they were eating their steaks.
Okay, I have a fundamental issue with this, though. I'm just thinking about the numbers we just learned.
Okay.
If Randy is talking to 40 retail investors, why isn't that a retail communication? It's in more than 25 people.
Because it is spontaneous spoken word.
Oh.
The 25-person rule specifically applies to written and electronic communications. The spoken word is ephemeral. FinerEye recognizes that you cannot physically regulate human speech in real time the way you can, you know, intercept a printed mailer.
Okay, let's test that logic then. Randy finishes his unscripted monologue.
Yep.
He then walks around the room and physically hands a slick 20-page, full-color printed slide deck to all 40 people in the audience.
And here is where the event splits its personality. The moment those physical packets hit the tables, you are no longer dealing with just a public appearance. You are dealing with a written document distributed to 40 retail investors.
Which is more than 25.
Okay.
So the slide deck itself is a retail communication.
Exactly. And what does a retail communication require?
Pre-approval.
Principal pre-approval before first use. Cautious Kathy must have read, reviewed, and officially signed off on that slide deck before Randy even loaded it into his car.
Right.
This is a classic exam scenario, by the way. The event itself is a public appearance, but the handouts trigger the retail communication rules simultaneously.
Okay, what if Randy gets stage fright? Like, he realizes he's actually terrible at winging it. So the night before, he writes out a 20-minute speech word for word.
Okay.
He stands at the steakhouse podium and reads directly from the script to the 40 people. Does that change anything?
Oh, the loophole closes immediately.
Oh, see?
Yeah, if the presentation is entirely scripted, the script itself is viewed as a written document being delivered to more than 25 retail investors.
Wow.
The entire event transitions from a public appearance into a retail communication. Kathy would have had to pre-approve the script, and Randy cannot deviate from it.
So the moment it's committed to paper, the regulatory burden skyrockets.
Yes, paper leaves a trail.
That makes sense.
Mm.
Okay, what about the Q&A at the end? Let's say a guy in the back raises his hand, asks Randy what he thinks about a specific, I don't know, biomedical stock. And Randy says, yeah, I think it's a strong buy.
Okay, if a registered rep makes a recommendation during a public appearance, two very strict rules kick in. First, Randy must have a reasonable basis for making that recommendation. He can't just guess or pull it out of thin air.
Right.
Second, he must clearly disclose any financial interest that he or his firm has in that specific security, unless the interest is purely nominal.
Wait, Define nominal in this context, because that feels vague.
Well, if Randy owns like 2 shares in his personal Robinhood account, that is nominal. It doesn't really move the needle on his net worth.
Okay.
But if his firm was the lead underwriter for that biomedical company, or if they hold a massive block of shares in their proprietary trading account, Randy has to state that conflict of interest out loud to the room before he praises the stock.
So he literally has to be like, I think it's a great buy. And by the way, my boss owns 10% of the company.
Yes.
You have to say the quiet part out loud.
Exactly. You have to level the playing field for the listener.
Okay, so we've mentioned Cautious Cathy having to approve things a few times now.
Mm-hmm.
Let's pivot and look at the actual mechanics of approvals, reviews, and when FINRA themselves get involved.
Yes, this is huge.
Because this is an area where the exam, they love to test your ability to distinguish between very similar sounding administrative procedures.
Right, the Cathy protocol, as it were.
Right. So before we get into the timelines, we have to establish the universal content standard.
Yes. It does not matter if a communication is retail, institutional, or correspondence. Every single thing a broker-dealer puts into the world must be fair and balanced.
See, what does fair and balanced actually mean in a regulatory context, though? Because it sounds incredibly subjective.
Well, it means you cannot predict or project future performance.
Okay.
You cannot omit material facts that would cause the communication to be misleading. And fundamentally, if you highlight a potential reward or a massive gain, you must simultaneously highlight the associated risks with equal prominence.
Right. So you can't put the upside in 72-point font and the downside in a size 4 footnote on the back page.
Exactly. No hiding the spinach.
No hiding the spinach. Got it. So that applies to everything. But how Cathy interacts with the material changes based on our 3 buckets, right? Let's compare pre-approval versus review procedures.
Okay.
So if Randy creates a retail communication, say, a billboard on the highway, Cathy must review and approve it before it is ever used, right? Pre-approval.
Hmm.
She has to physically sign off on the billboard art.
Right. Because a retail communication has the highest potential to mislead a large number of, you know, unsophisticated investors.
Yeah.
But if Randy is writing an institutional communication to Frank the founder, or he's sending correspondence to just 20 retail clients, the rules relax. Cathy does not need to pre-approve those.
Wait, she doesn't have to read it at all before it goes out?
Not before it goes out, no. For institutional and correspondence, FINR requires the firm to have written review procedures.
Okay, what does that look like?
This means the firm might sample a percentage of emails after the fact, or they might rely on heavy training and automated surveillance software to flag risky keywords.
Oh, I see.
So Cathy can review it post-use, but the firm must have a robust system in place to ensure compliance overall.
So retail is a hard stop at Cathy's desk. Institutional and correspondence are more of an auditing process later on.
Exactly.
Okay, that is internal. But when does FINRA want to see the marketing materials? Because I assume they don't trust broker-dealers to police themselves entirely.
They absolutely do not. FINRA filing requirements apply exclusively to retail communications.
Just retail.
Just retail. And the timeline for when you have to submit that communication to FINRA depends heavily on the tenure of the firm. FINRA divides the world into new members and established members.
Okay, a new member is a firm in its first year of operation, right? They just got their license.
Exactly. They are rookies. And FINRA puts rookies on regulatory probation.
Makes sense.
So if a new member firm creates a broadly disseminated retail communication, like a website, a print ad, a television commercial, they must file it with FINRA 10 business days before first use.
Okay, let me stop you there. 10 business days. I want to drill into this. Because it feels like FINRA flips a coin between calendar and business days just to torture test takers.
It does feel like that, but it isn't arbitrary.
Okay, why business days here?
Think about the physical logistics. A new member firm is untested. FINRA regulators sitting in their offices in Rockville, Maryland, actually need time to sit at their desks, drink their coffee, and read the rookie's marketing materials to make sure they aren't, you know, launching a Ponzi scheme.
Right, right.
That human review process requires working hours, Monday through Friday. Hence, 10 business days to allow the bureaucracy to process the filing.
Okay, that logic makes it so much easier to remember. Business days are for human bureaucratic processing.
Yes.
But what happens on day 366? Like, the firm survives its first year and officially becomes an established member.
The training wheels come off. Generally speaking, an established member does not have to file their standard retail communications before use.
Oh, nice.
FINRA trusts that they know the rules by now. However, For certain complex or risky products, FINRA still wants to see the ads.
Okay.
But the timeline shifts. For these specific products, an established firm must file the retail communication within 10 business days after first use.
Post-use filing.
Post-use.
So Kathy approves it internally, Randy runs the ad, and then Kathy has a 10-day window to basically send a copy to FINRA for their records.
Precisely. And the products that trigger this post-use filing requirement are usually things like mutual funds, variable annuities, direct participation programs, and collateralized mortgage obligations, or CMOs.
Okay, let me throw a quick scenario at you to lock this in.
Go for it.
Our firm has been in business for 5 years. We are fully established.
Right.
Randy creates a brand new retail flyer advertising a high-yield mutual fund. When does FINRA need to see it? And listeners, think about this before he answers.
So you are an established member advertising an investment company product. The rule is within 10 business days after first use.
Boom. Nailed it. But there is a monster lurking in the rule book, isn't there?
There is.
There is one major exception. There is one specific financial product where even a 30-year-old, fully established, blue-chip firm has to file their retail communications with FINRA before they are allowed to use them.
Yep.
And that brings us to the highly regulated world of options.
All options. Options are derivatives. They are inherently complex, highly leveraged, and incredibly risky.
Yeah.
You can lose your entire investment in a matter of days. Because of this, FINRA regulates communications about options with extreme prejudice.
Extreme prejudice. I like that.
That's true. And the entire framework revolves around a single physical document, the Options Disclosure Document, or ODD.
Okay, I always picture the ODD as like a bright yellow hazmat manual.
That's a great visual.
It is the foundational safety guide for options trading, right?
Yeah.
It details every single way a trade can blow up in your face.
That is exactly what it is. And the regulatory philosophy is simple. You cannot pitch the thrilling upside of options to a retail customer before they have received the safety manual. It is strictly forbidden.
So what triggers the delivery of that manual? Is it their first trade? Like, oh, you bought an option, here's the book.
No. The first trade is way too late. The ODD must be delivered to the customer at or before the time their account is approved for options trading.
Ah, at approval.
Yes. And by the way, in the modern era, emailing a hyperlink to the ODD totally counts as delivery, as long as it takes them directly to the document.
Okay. So we have two distinct universes then, pre-ODD and post-ODD.
Yes.
Let's say Randy is trying to drum up new business. He wants to send out a massive mailer to 10,000 retail investors who do not currently have options accounts. He's trying to convince them to sign up.
Okay.
This is a pre-ODD retail communication. What is the filing requirement?
Okay, listener, pay attention because this is a massive exam trap. Any retail communication concerning options used prior to ODD delivery must be filed with FINRA 10 calendar days before use.
Calendar days. Everyone listening, highlight that in your brain right now. 10 calendar days, not business days like the new member rule.
Well,
okay, I need you to explain this to me because we just established that FINRA uses business days because humans need time to review things at their desks.
Well,
why the sudden switch to calendar days for options?
It comes down to the mechanics of the options market itself. Options are highly volatile instruments driven by strict, unyielding expiration dates.
Right.
Time decay doesn't stop on the weekends. The market operates on a ticking clock. So when FINRA mandates a pre-use filing for options, they aren't just giving their staff time to read it. They're imposing a strict mathematical cooling off period.
A quarantine.
Calendar days create an absolute immovable time barrier that ignores holidays and weekends. It ensures a rigid delay before a broker can unleash complex derivatives marketing on the unsuspecting public.
Wow. So business days are for bureaucratic processing, but calendar days are a market timing quarantine.
Excellent.
That makes total sense. Now, what can Randy actually put in that pre-ODD mailer during this quarantine phase?
Almost nothing. The content restrictions are incredibly severe. Because the customer hasn't read the safety manual yet, Randy cannot recommend any specific option strategy.
Oh.
He cannot show past performance. He cannot show projected future performance.
Mm-hmm.
Most importantly, he cannot even name specific securities.
Are you serious? He can't even write, like, hey, want to learn how to buy call options on Apple stock?
Absolutely not. The moment he mentions Apple, it's a violation.
Wow.
A pre-ODD communication can only contain generic descriptions of how options work, brief descriptions of the options exchanges, and crucially, instructions on how the customer can actually obtain the options disclosure document. It is strictly a generic educational piece.
So it's literally just a billboard that says, options exist, ask for the manual.
That's it.
Okay, but what happens after the customer gets the ODD and their account is finally approved? What is the post-ODD reality for Randy?
Complete freedom, relatively speaking. Once the safety manual is in their hands, the standard communications rules apply. Randy can name specific stocks, he can show historical performance, he can recommend strategies.
Okay, good.
But he is still bound by the universal standard, fair and balanced. If he sends an email claiming a specific strategy could generate a 50% return, he must include a risk statement of equal specificity detailing how they could lose the entire premium paid.
Okay.
You cannot whisper the risks and shout the rewards.
Yeah, that makes sense. Options are definitely in a league of their own. But Cautious Kathy has a few other products that keep her up at night, don't they?
Oh, definitely.
The exam explicitly targets the marketing rules for three specific vehicles: mutual funds, variable contracts, and CMOs.
Yep, the big three.
Let's tackle these one by one, starting with mutual funds, which the exam might refer to as investment companies.
Right. The primary battleground for mutual fund advertising is performance data. Registered reps always want to show off the highest possible returns to attract capital.
Right, obviously.
Yeah.
So Randy looks at his favorite tech-heavy mutual fund. Over the last 10 years, it's been pretty average. But between February and August of last year, it surged 40%.
Okay, I see where this is going.
So Randy designs a flyer that only shows that six-month window. It just says, look at this, we are up 40%. Can you do that?
Kathy would throw that flyer straight in the shredder.
I figured.
Yeah. Yeah, the SEC requires performance data in mutual fund advertising to be strictly standardized. You cannot cherry pick favorable timeframes.
Okay.
If you show performance, you are required to show the average annual total returns for 1, 5, and 10-year periods. If the fund hasn't existed for 10 years, you show the life of the fund.
So it forces you to zoom out.
Exactly. This forces the broker to present the long-term reality of the investment, flattening out those anomalous short-term spikes that Randy loves so much.
Okay, what about delivering the prospectus? Because a full statutory prospectus for a mutual fund reads like a legal dictionary. It's like 100 pages of dense text. Do we really have to mail a physical copy of that to every person who buys a share?
Thankfully, no. The SEC modernized that rule. You can satisfy the delivery requirement by providing what's called a summary prospectus.
Summary prospectus.
Yeah. This is a few pages of plain English that highlights the fund's objectives, fees, and risks. The massive full statutory prospectus just has to be hosted online, freely accessible, or mailed within 3 business days if the client specifically demands a paper copy.
Okay. That saves a lot of trees.
It really does.
Okay. Let's talk about bond funds for a second, because this is tricky. A bond funder's value is inversely related to interest rates.
Correct.
When rates go up, the value of the bonds in the fund goes down. Some funds are highly sensitive to this. Like when the Federal Reserve sneezes, the bond fund's price swings wildly like a seesaw.
Right, like a trampoline.
Yes, a trampoline. So if I am Randy and I see a bond fund swinging violently up and down on a trampoline, I want to label it a high-risk bond fund.
And if you do, you will fail the exam and get heavily fined by FINRA.
But why? Swings in price are risky. If I'm an investor, that's risk.
In layman's terms, yes. But in the highly specific language of finance, risk almost exclusively implies credit risk.
Credit risk.
Yeah, the risk of actual default. The risk that the issuer goes bankrupt and cannot pay you back. A fund made entirely of U.S. Treasury bonds has essentially zero credit risk because the government won't default.
Right.
However, a 30-year Treasury bond will swing violently in price if interest rates change. The asset is safe from default, but the price mechanism is highly unstable.
Mm-hmm.
Therefore, FINRA mandates that you use the term volatility rating. You are measuring the volatility of the price, not the risk of bankruptcy.
Okay, that distinction is brilliant. It's a volatility rating, never a risk rating. And I bet the exam gives you a multiple choice question where one of the juicy answers is bond fund risk rating.
They absolutely will. And you will not fall for it.
Right, because it's volatility. Okay, let's move to the second nightmare product, variable contracts. So we are talking about variable annuities and variable life insurance.
Yes. These are hybrid products. They combine the mortality features of insurance with the market risk of mutual funds.
Right.
And they pay enormous commissions, which means brokers like Randy aggressively push them on everyone.
What is FINRA Range's main concern with how variable annuities are marketed?
Liquidity, or rather, the total lack of it. Variable annuities are designed for long-term retirement planning. If you pull your money out early, the insurance company hits you with massive surrender charges, and it gets worse. If you pull it out before age 59 and a half, the IRS hits you with a 10% penalty on top of ordinary income tax. It is a financially devastating move.
So if Randy writes an ad that implies a variable annuity is a great place to park your cash for a year while you, you know, look for a house.
It is a profound violation. Any communication regarding variable contracts must clearly and prominently state that they are long-term investments, and any mention of liquidity must be immediately counterbalanced by a stark warning about the surrender charges and tax penalties.
Okay, here is an area where I know people get confused, and I've been confused by it too. The guarantees.
Oh, this is a big one.
Yeah. So Randy is pitching a nervous client on a variable annuity. He says, don't worry about the stock market crashing. This contract comes with a guaranteed minimum death benefit. Your principal is totally safe. Where does that guarantee actually come from?
This is the crux of how these products work. A variable annuity has two distinct accounts. First, the separate account.
Okay.
This is where the client rose money is invested in mutual fund-like subaccounts. It is directly tied to the stock market. If the market crashes 40%, the separate account drops 40%. There's absolutely no guarantee in the separate account.
So if the separate account is tanking, how can Randy promise a guaranteed death benefit? That feels illegal.
Because the guarantee comes from the second account. The insurance company is general account.
General account.
Yes. This is the corporate reserves of the insurance company itself. The exam will test this aggressively. Any guarantee in a variable contract depends only on the claims-paying ability of the issuing insurance company.
Meaning, if the insurance company goes bankrupt, your guarantee is basically worthless paper.
Exactly. You are relying on the financial strength of the corporation, not the performance of your mutual funds. Brokers must disclose this clearly. You cannot imply that the guarantee protects the investment performance of the separate account.
That makes total sense. Also, if Randy is showing a client a hypothetical illustration, like a chart showing how their money might grow over 20 years in this annuity, he has to follow a very specific rule regarding the assumed rate of return, right?
Yes, the 0% rule.
The 0% rule.
When presenting hypothetical illustrations for variable life insurance or annuities, the broker is permitted to show assumed growth rates, usually up to 12% as long as it's reasonable, but they are mandated to also show a 0% return scenario.
Wow. They have to explicitly show the client what happens if the investment makes absolutely nothing for 20 years.
Yes, because even if the market return is zero, the insurance company is still deducting mortality and expense fees every single year. The client needs to see how those fees will slowly bleed the account value down if the market remains flat. It is a harsh but completely necessary reality check.
That is brutal, but yeah, it's necessary. All right, the third and final specific product, CMOs. Collateralized mortgage obligations.
Rule number one for CMOs is incredibly simple but highly testable. In any retail communication, you must spell out the entire name. You cannot just use the acronym CMO. It must prominently state collateralized mortgage obligation.
Because they want the investor to physically see the word mortgage so they understand what is backing the security. Okay, now let's talk about how you sell them. Direct question for the listener. Randy is sitting across from a conservative retiree. Randy says, look, this CMO is yielding 6%. Your bank CD is only yielding 4%. You should move your money to the CMO for the better yield. Can Randy make that direct comparison?
Listeners, pause and think about the underlying mechanics of those two products.
I mean, he absolutely cannot, right?
Right.
That comparison ban is incredibly strict. But why? Like, they both have yields. They both seem like fixed income. Why can't you compare them?
Two words. Prepayment risk.
Prepayment risk.
Let's break down the mechanics. A certificate of deposit at a bank has a fixed term and a guaranteed yield. It does not matter what the Federal Reserve does. Your CD pays 4% until it matures. A CMO, however, is a pool of thousands of individual home mortgages.
Okay, so if I buy a CMO, I am basically collecting the mortgage payments from thousands of random homeowners.
Right. Now, imagine you buy a CMO backed by mortgages with a 7% interest rate. You are enjoying that high yield. Life is good.
Yeah.
But suddenly, the Federal Reserve slashes interest rates. Mortgage rates drop to 5%. What does every homeowner in America immediately do?
Well, they refinance.
Yeah.
They go to the bank, get a new mortgage at 5%, and use that money to pay off the old 7% mortgage.
Exactly. And when they pay off that old mortgage, that cash is immediately returned to you, the CMO investor. Your 7% yielding investment is suddenly gone it vanished. And now you are holding a pile of cash in a 5% interest rate environment. You have to reinvest at a lower rate. Your yield was completely obliterated.
Wow.
This is prepayment risk. You cannot compare a fluctuating, highly uncertain yield, heavily dependent on homeowner behavior, to a federally insured guaranteed bank CD. It is apples and hand grenades.
Apples and hand grenades. That is a phenomenal explanation. The yield on a CMO is a total mirage if rates drop. And because prepayment risk is the defining feature, FINRA has a very specific rule for advertising CMOs on television or the radio, don't they?
They do. If you broadcast an advertisement for a CMO, the audio must explicitly state that the yield and the average life of the investment reflect prepayment assumptions that may or may not be met. They literally force you to say the quiet part out loud on the airwaves.
I love it. You have to tell them it might vanish.
Yeah.
Okay, we've spent a lot of time on marketing products to clients, but what about the research we produce for them? This is the final major section, research reports. And this is really all about avoiding the sins of the past.
Specifically, the sins of the late 90s dot-com bubble. The regulations governing research reports are entirely focused on managing conflicts of interest and ensuring a level playing field. FINRA despises it when retail investors are treated as second-class citizens behind big institutional money.
Okay, let's run a scenario here. Our firm has a brilliant tech analyst. She just wrote a massive market-moving research report upgrading a major software company to a strong buy. It's going to make waves. Randy gets his hands on the final draft. He decides to quietly email it to Frank the Founder's hedge fund on Thursday night, 12 hours before the firm officially releases it to the retail clients on Friday morning. Just a little VIP sneak peek for the big spender.
That is a massive violation. The rule explicitly prohibits selective distribution. A broker-dealer must have strict written policies in place to prevent exactly this. Every single client who is entitled to receive that research report must receive it at substantially the same time.
Okay.
You cannot grant early access to favored institutional clients so they can front-run the retail investors. The playing field must be level.
What about quiet periods? Because this is a concept that came directly out of those dot-com scandals, right?
It did. Let's look at the conflict of interest here. Imagine our firm's investment banking division is making $50 million in fees to underwrite the initial public offering of a new internet company. They have a massive financial incentive to see that stock price skyrocket on opening day. So, if our firm's research analyst immediately goes on television and screams, "This stock is a guaranteed winner, buy it now," is that objective research or is that a disguised sales pitch to prop up the investment bankers?
It's a sales pitch. The analyst is just hyping the firm's own product.
Exactly. To combat this, regulators impose a quiet period. This is a legally mandated quarantine period where a firm involved in underwriting and offering is strictly forbidden from publishing research reports or making public appearances regarding that specific company. It legally separates the sales desk from the research desk.
Okay, let's lock in the exact timelines for this because I know the exam loves testing these specific numbers. If a company is going public for the very first time, an IPO, how long is the quiet period?
For an IPO, the quiet period is 10 days following the date of the offering. And this applies to any member firm that participated as a manager, a co-manager, a syndicate member, or even just a selling group dealer. If you touch the IPO, you are quiet for 10 days.
Note for the listener, older study materials might say 40 days. The rule was updated years ago, so don't get tricked. The exam tests the current 10-day rule.
Yes.
Now, what if the company is already public, but they are issuing more shares, like a secondary offering?
The rules relax slightly because the stock already has an established public market price, right? It's not as susceptible to initial hype. For a secondary offering, the quiet period is only 3 days.
3 days, okay.
Furthermore, it only applies to the managers and co-managers of the underwriting syndicate.
Wait, so if our firm is just a lower tier syndicate member helping sell the secondary offering, but we aren't managing it?
Then your quiet period is 0 days. You can publish research immediately. The 3-day restriction only applies to the top of the food chain, the managers.
Let's quickly recap that just to be safe.
Yeah.
IPO, 10 days for everybody involved. Oh, secondary yeah. offering, 3 days for managers, 0 days for everyone else.
Perfect summary. And there is one final piece of the research puzzle, third-party research. Sometimes a smaller broker-dealer just doesn't have the budget to employ their own analysts. So they buy a research report from an independent firm and distribute it to their clients under their own letterhead.
Right. If we didn't write it, Is Cautious Kathy still on the hook for approving it? Can't she just say, hey, we just bought it. Don't blame us if it's wrong.
Oh, she is absolutely on the hook. If a member firm distributes third-party research, a principal or a supervisory analyst at the firm must review and approve it before it is sent out. They must ensure the research is objective and reliable, and the report must be clearly labeled as third-party research, explicitly disclosing the name of the firm that actually produced it. You cannot wash your hands of the compliance burden just because you outsourced the writing.
Man, Kathy's job truly never ends. All right, take a breath. We have covered a staggering amount of regulatory ground here. We categorized the buckets, we survived Randy A. Steakhouse seminar, we decoded the timelines, and we navigated the specific nightmares of options, annuities, CMOs, and research.
It is a dense forest of rules, I know, but hopefully the underlying logic is starting to emerge for people.
Definitely. And to make sure it sticks, we're going to close out with a rapid-fire recap. I'm going to throw out the concept. You give me the testable takeaway. Listeners, try to shout out the answer before the expert does.
I'm ready.
Here we go. Retail communication threshold.
More than 25 retail investors within any rolling 30 calendar day period.
Internal communications to coworkers.
They sit entirely outside the three categories. They are not correspondents.
Speaking unscripted at a seminar.
Public appearance. No pre-approval required, but the firm must have supervisory procedures.
Handing out a physical slide deck to 40 people at that same seminar.
Retail communication. Requires principal pre-approval before first use.
Filing a retail communication for options before the ODD is delivered.
10 calendar days before use. A strict mathematical quarantine.
Filing a retail communication for a brand new member firm.
10 business days before use. Time for human bureaucrats to read it.
Where do variable contract guarantees come from?
The insurance company's general account, their claims paying ability, never the separate account.
What do you call a bond fund's price fluctuation metric?
A volatility rating. Never, ever a risk rating.
CMO advertising rules.
Spell out collateralized mortgage obligation, highlight prepayment risk, and never compare the yield to a bank CD.
Quiet period for an IPO.
10 days for all underwriters and dealers.
Boom. If you can rattle those off, you are going to absolutely crush this section of the Series 7.
I agree completely. When you stop trying to blindly memorize numbers and start asking why Finara wrote the rule, whether it's to enforce a level playing field, isolate a volatile product, or give their own staff time to read a rookie's marketing, the rulebook actually becomes quite logical.
It really does. You survived the regulatory gauntlet with Reckless Randy, Cautious Kathy, and Frank the founder. You should feel incredibly confident about this material. But before we sign off, I know you always like to leave us with a thought that pushes, you know, beyond the textbook.
I do. We have spent this entire time talking about how strictly FINRA regulates static written materials and human speech. But think about the rapidly approaching future of AI-generated content.
Oh, well.
Yeah. Imagine an artificial intelligence engine connected to a broker's social media. The AI analyzes a prospective client's online footprint in real time and instantly generates a highly personalized, dynamic, interactive financial presentation tailored specifically to their psychological profile and then delivers it via a hyper-realistic avatar.
That's terrifying.
It is. But is that a public appearance because it's spoken and dynamic? Or is it a retail communication because the algorithm is essentially operating off a written script? How does a compliance officer pre-approve an AI that creates unique content at the exact moment of delivery? The regulations we studied today were built for paper and podiums. The next decade is going to shatter them.
Wow. Cautious Kathy's going to need a lot more than Tums when that day comes. This is a wild thought to chew on. All right. Thank you all for joining us in this deep dive. Keep grinding. Focus on the mechanics and go crush your Series 7 exam. We'll see you next time.